Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about the 1955 novel The Chrysalids by John Wyndham. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Welcome to our 15th episode.
Is this officially our 15th episode? Because I think we've lost track.
Yeah, well, we might have, but I think now every time it's a vaguely round number, I'm just excited, so...
Is 15 a round number? Anytime it's an odd or even number.
I'm just impressed every time we do one of these.
You're right. That's the spirit I should have. So this is our special 15th episode.
Oh, check us out. Well done. Well done to us. And it's The Chrysalids by John Wyndham.
So Chrysalids. Because I'm going to keep mispronouncing this, like crispy lips or something. The crispy lips. That sounds creepier.
The chrysalids, or just to be different, I'm reading an American copy from the 1970s, which instead is called Rebirth.
Oh, okay, that's nice. I thought it'd be called Damned Telepathic Commies or something.
And it seems to have some minor differences from the original text. For example, there's a relatively minor character called Rachel in presumably your copy, who's called Deborah in mine.
Nice.
No idea why, but there you go.
I guess Deborah, they probably focus tested it and Deborah goes down better with American audiences.
I guess. I don't know. So if there's any other things that I say and you're like, I don't think it does that, then maybe it's just...
like, if you're like, and then of course there's that scene with the giant penguin.
What? Yeah. So that might just spice it up a little bit. Mackie, who's our delightful intro music composer, suggested this one.
Oh,
John Wyndham's her favourite author, and on her suggestions, I've read quite a few of his novels over the last few years. And I think this one most fits the bill, as it's definitely quite scary, and the protagonists are children/teenagers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has similar thematics to most young adult. To lots of young adult sort of adventure kind of fiction, right? Like a group of plucky outsiders having to band together against some form of state or organised persecution with an extended chase sequence with moments of peril.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, I don't know whether it would have been written specifically for a young adult audience. I'm not sure it would have been, but...
it was published in 1955, so I'm not sure that was, I don't know.
My mum liked John Wyndham as a young adult, so I think if I'd read this when I was a teenager, I wouldn't have felt like, oh, I'm reading something for grown-ups here. You know, I wouldn't have felt like, oh, this is definitely adult literature. I think it would have seemed like it was kind of written for me.
Yeah, it seems to often be set as a set text in schools for this sort of GCSE age.
I noticed that actually because I listened to Google the audio. Well, I listened to the audio version on YouTube. Oh, okay. And a lot of the comments were saying things like, this is so boring, I have to listen to this, but I don't want to. So that could have cued me into thinking it must be some kind of set text.
Yeah. Well, we read it because we wanted to.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I read it because you told me to, but, you know, obviously I wanted to for the podcast. I mean, I might try to make you read Water Babies for next week, though. So.
Okay.
Anyway, Crispy Lips.
Yeah, it's set in a small town called Whacknook in Labrador, Newfoundland, or Newf, as they call it.
Is that what the kids call it?
It's lost the rest of its name to over the generations. But to
nuclear decay.
Yeah. they live an unspecified number of generations past the tribulation, which is a sort of catastrophic nuclear event. On all sides, they're surrounded by fringes, which then sort of bleed into badlands, which are areas that become progressively more afflicted by fallout and less inhabitable. So because of this, the people of Whacknook, with the main character, David's preacher father at the forefront, are extremely vigilant about destroying crops and animals that are deviant or mutated in any way, and that they therefore see as offences to God. Newborn babies are also subject to visits from the inspector, who determines if they are true forms or a blasphemy, which deviates from the physical norm in any way, and is consequently banished as subhuman. So they're made to recite the definition of man, which part of it goes, and each leg shall be jointed twice and have one foot, and each foot five toes, and each toe shall end with a flat nail, and so on. And it's kind of like that knee bones connected to the thigh bone song, but sinister.
I did actually have to, not knowing my Bible very well, I had to check whether it was actually in the Bible. It's not.
It's not, no. This is the bit they've added on.
Not that I would have put it past the Bible, I have to say.
So, the story starts when David's about 9 years old and he goes off exploring and meets a girl called Sophie, who secretly has six toes on each foot. And he finds this out by accident because she's sprained her ankle. So we have the juxtaposition of sort of learning about his father's extreme religious bigotry. At the same time, David is befriending someone who's the target of it. There's one detail about his father. Is that he killed a neighbor's tailless cat. he decided it was an offense and went vigilante style after this cat before the information reached the community that cats without tails were a recognized breed. So that's the kind of guy he is.
I like that that's the main reason. You're like, yeah, he's definitely a bad guy. Kills freaking cats.
Kills a cat.
Cat killer. Don't matter if he's a baby killer, but cat killer. Well, I say baby killer as they leave the babies to fend for themselves out in the elements. So I think it's fair to call him a baby killer.
I was wondering about that because... and how that logistically worked, because there are people living in the fringes, but surely if they checked them all as babies, then how would...
Well, they were just really hardcore babies.
Okay. I guess so.
I mean, so, I don't know, the Romans did it, so, you know, like... I guess. I don't know where I'm going with that at all. I hate the Romans.
Yeah, Romans are
poo.
Yeah.
God, I'm going to have to put an explicit language tag on this one now.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Because of my disgust at Romans.
I'm going to... I'll dub it out or something. I'll replace a word in your voice.
It's fine. We are allowed to swear.
No, it'll be seamless. We might have children listeners. You know? I don't want to be some corrupter of the youth.
Okay. So...
It'll be fine. It'll be seamless.
So yeah, there is another, apart from the cat thing, there is another harrowing early scene in which David overhears his aunt coming to their house in distress with his baby, who has apparently one little thing different about it. Neither he nor the reader finds out what that thing is. And she's asking his mum if she can borrow David's newborn little sister to show the inspector instead. And her mother is aghast and calls the baby a monster, and his father banishes her from the house, and the next morning both her and the baby are found drowned. Pretty...
I bet it was a sticky-out belly button like I have.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that we don't really know how far they go with this. Like...
They seem pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty fiercely pedantic, I think.
Yeah.
But, of course, they aren't so able to police inner differences. Yes. And so it transpires that our young protagonist is different in his own way, in that he can produce and receive thought shapes or thought images.
Hmm.
So yeah. This is a kind of telepathy, basically, a sort of emotional, pre-linguistic or semi-linguistic telepathy.
Mm.
I mean, you've said before that, because I very much have a kind of Mark Corrigan-esque inner monologue constantly, but you say you do have quite a lot of sort of abstract thoughts that aren't really translatable to language, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think I just think in pictures and shapes and stuff quite a lot.
So maybe it's like if you could, you know, transmit those things to people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, sort of. It's not quite the same as language.
More like the texture of the week.
Yeah.
but anyway, is David the main character's name? Yeah, so David and his cousin both have this ability.
Yes, and then a group of other children and young people sort of in the surrounding area who come to know each other just through sharing the thought shapes together. And so there's quite a lot of threat and foreboding in the from the start of the novel, because you see how hostile the environment is to physical differences, and doesn't seem like they'll be any more accommodating to David and the others if they found out about their difference. He has a kind of insider-outsider character is his uncle, Uncle Axel, who was a sailor and who's sort of sailed round bits of the continent and sort of seen the Badlands and the strange mutated landscapes.
Axolotl experiences.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I can't resist an axolotl reference. I just love them.
Yeah.
They're good friends, Adam.
Aww. and dedicated listeners.
And dedicated listeners, yeah. Shout out to all those axolotls. So he finds out that about sort of sees David sort of muttering to himself and asks about it and finds out that he's communicating with his cousin Rosalind and tells him, "Oh, you better not, you better not let people find out about this." So he sort of teaches David and the rest to be cautious, and so they kind of grow up under the threat of being found out. And
traumatically, Sophie, the girl David meets at the beginning of the book, does get found out.
Yeah. So they go paddling together, and so she kind of very daringly takes off her boots and goes paddling in the stream. But then someone unexpectedly, a boy from the village, turns up, and Sophie leaves a six-toed footprint on the rock, which he sees. So they go back to Sophie's parents, and they're like, right, we have to leave. So they pack the family off, and then David's father beats him until he finds out about Sophie. The family end up getting caught by a patrol. Which is fairly horrifying.
Yeah, it's genuinely, it's funny, I guess, because I suppose partly being a 1950s writer, John Wyndham has a fairly kind of restrained style. Like, there's no pornographic detail in the books whatsoever. But there are times where it really did remind me of, say, the Fallout games or Apocalypse World or other kind of more lurid post-apocalyptic narratives. Because there is real horror in it, especially in terms of this policing of difference the fates awaiting those who are deemed to be mutants.
We find out much later in the book that Sophie is still alive, but she's been sterilised and sent to the Fringes to eke out an existence as best she can.
I think he actually, to his credit, did quite a good job at getting across the psychological impact of this as well when we meet Sophie again.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's pretty disturbing as we've seen her as, a happy, sort of carefree kid.
Earlier in the book, I think she's quite sort of appealing little kid when she's young, that. Yeah.
And you see how traumatised she's been by this, and how hard her life has been.
I just had to say that, so I've just read through a incredibly variable anthology edited by Harlan Ellison, so I probably should have known what I was in for a bit more, from the 1960s, called Dangerous Visions.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like sort of seminal sci-fi anthology, and some of the stories had their moments. Some seemed very paranoid in retrospect. there was one about the future of organ donation. I guess organ donation had just sort of become viable in the 1960s, and it basically, in the afterword, the writer says, "Well, you may think this is a good thing now, but just you wait, they'll be executing people for speeding and all sorts, just so people can get to their lovely organs." So very convinced that, by the 1980s, this was going to be the case.
Yeah.
But a lot of the stories were just really tiresomely and hideously misogynist. I think a lot of older sci-fi is really misogynist, and that's not something I get from Wyndham.
This is one of the actually great things about Wyndham, is that he writes proper female characters.
And I think it's fair to say that that's rare for male sci-fi authors.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rare for male authors, but it's particularly...
Male sci-fi authors of the 50s, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, props to Wyndham for that. And I think, actually, the female characters in this book are slightly more compelling, I think, than the male characters. David, as a protagonist, spends most of the time slightly befuddled, almost.
He's not the most compelling of characters. He's just a fairly sort of bland kind of narrator.
Yeah, whereas I think Rosalind, I found more interesting. She seemed to have a kind of richer internal life to me.
Hmm. Yeah, and there's Rosalind and Sophie and
is it Anne and Catherine?
Even like Sally and Catherine, and then David's little sister Petra as well. So there's this great deal of threat that when they're growing up, and one sort of thing that seems like it might expose them is that one of their group, Anne, decides to marry a Norm, which one of them describes as like pretending to only have one arm because the person one wants to marry has only one arm. So she decides that she's not going to communicate with thoughts at all. She's just going to be a normal person. So she cuts off all communication with them. But then about a year into her marriage, her husband's found shot dead by an arrow and Anne commits suicide. And it's revealed later that it was Uncle Axel who killed her husband because he realised that Anne had told him about her power, about the other people who had it, and that he would use it to blackmail them. And Anne herself leaves a note for the inspector denouncing all of them. One of their number, I think it's Rachel/Deborah, gets to it intercept it.
It's her sister.
Mm. So that's kind of one narrow escape, but then the actual sort of crunch point comes from David's little sister Petra,
whose psychic powers are clearly far in advance or far more powerful than any of the other characters.
Mackie is saying that she finds Petra slightly unnerving. Like a touch of Midwich Cuckoo about her, kind of.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Midwich Cuckoo's comes after this book by a few years. But I can totally see that. And it's interesting because Midwich Cuckoo's is basically the inverse of this book. It's the psychic children treated as the antagonists, nominally at least. Whereas here, obviously, they're the sympathetic protagonists.
It's sort of interesting to read them sort of side by side, because the Midwich Cuckoos have they have this power that they can prevent their mothers from leaving them, so their mothers can't leave the village as they just stop them. But Petra, they find out about her power because she falls in a river and produces this overwhelming signal to all the people with the with the same ability.
Yeah, sends out this shockwave and they're all sort of magnetised almost towards it.
Yeah. Which is quite a dangerous thing to happen because it means they're running towards her and no one knows like how they find out that she's in danger. So it's just David and Rosalind that time, and they sort of go, oh, couldn't you hear her screaming? Kind of, we did, sort of thing. And they kind of...
not very convincingly.
Yeah, but they managed to get away with it. But the second time it happens, which is a few years later, Petra is riding in the forest, which she's not meant to do, and some sort of mutated creature attacks her pony. So it's ripping its throat out. So she's sort of clinging to a tree and emitting this again, like a really intense distress signal. And all of them start running towards her, or riding towards her.
Very much one of the points in the book where I was imagining proceedings like a D&D or Fighting Fantasy campaign.
Yeah. So she sort of unwittingly gathers the whole group towards her, and they manage to send some of them away again, but it's still David, Rosalind and Sally and Catherine are all there in the forest, and someone comes across and is just sort of inexplicable how they would all know that Petra was in distress.
And I like the fact that Rosalind in particular is not afraid to voice her occasional affectionate irritation towards Petra.
Yeah, Petra is
So later on, Petra starts communicating with another psychic person who is broadcasting their thought shapes, it turns out, from all the way from New Zealand. And they start communicating with this woman, and she expresses that Petra is especially unique and tremendously important, and that the kids have to protect her at all costs.
Yeah.
And then it says, then Petra came in. Whatever she may have failed to make of the rest, she had caught the last part all right. That's me, she proclaimed with satisfaction and totally unnecessary vigour. We rocked and recovered. Beware, odious smug child. We haven't met Hairy Jack yet, Rosalind told her, with subduing effect.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. Petra's, her, she's so powerful that she's like a, what is it, like Obelix and Asterix and Obelix. She doesn't know her own strength. She fell in a cauldron as a baby and now she's incredibly psychic. But
cauldron of atomic power.
Yeah. But she's kind of doing the telepathic equivalent of constantly bellowing in the other people's ears.
Yeah.
You have to keep telling her to quiet down. Petra, David and Rosalind managed to escape before the inspector comes to their door, but the two other girls, Sally and Catherine, are taken to the inspector, and this is one of the main points of horror in the book, is that they're interrogated and Catherine's tortured into giving up the information. And because of their shared ability, the torture has this particular horrible extra aspect to it, where it says when they hear from Catherine, it's like, it was not a thought shape. It had no real form. It was sheer distress, like a cry of agony. Petra gasped and threw herself whimpering into Rosalind's arms. The impact was so sharp it hurt. So... yeah, we learn that Catherine has been tortured into giving up the information. And they all sort of feel that shock
to yeah.
a certain extent.
I've seen quite a few YouTube videos about empaths recently. And I suppose it's similar to if someone's sort of deeply empathetic and soaks up all the emotions of others like a sponge, that sometimes this is going to be very loving and good, and sometimes it's going to be extraordinarily painful.
Mm. I don't know, have you ever read The Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler?
No, I haven't. I think my dad had. I think I bought it for my dad at some point, but I haven't actually read it.
Yeah, it's incredibly harrowing and powerful. But the main character in that is her parents was addicted to some kind of drug, so she has this intense empath ability, so that if she sees someone in pain, she shares their pain.
But not children's horror, presumably.
No, really not at all. I recommend it, but it's really, really intense. Anyway. Back to this book.
The kids flee, understandably.
Mm.
They know they've been discovered, and so they hot-tail it towards the wastelands, basically, or the badlands.
Yeah, they go to the fringes, which is the kind of the part where people are abandoned to if they're seen as deviants or whatever. But it's kind of where the crops and the animals and the plants are all starting to sort of grow in sort of unrecognisable forms. Like, they're not wholly unrecognizable yet, but they're not
eldritch forms.
Yeah. And then so the last sort of part of the novel is really this quite extended chase sequence where Petra, David and Rosalind are on the run, and Petra's in touch with this woman from Zealand, as they call it, who is so vastly impressed with Petra's ability that she is commanding an airship halfway around the world to rescue them. Although she's also quite blatantly uninterested in any of them apart from Petra.
Yeah, which I wasn't sure how is interesting, because, you know, well, a spoiler, but they get rescued, or at least most of them. And ostensibly it's a happy ending, I guess. Mm. But I think we're not... I don't know. I was interested in to what degree you thought we were meant to trust the New Zealanders or think that they were utopian, or whether they were kind of replacing one prison for a new prison.
It's ambiguous. Because the Zealand woman is, I mean, she's not the most comforting of characters. She has this habit of sort of speaking in kind of didactic pronouncements and speeches about the sort of new world that they're making in Zealand, and how they're brought together by the power of this think together ability.
Is she a communist? Or is it a technocratic communist? I don't know.
Well, I've got a quote from her. It's like, we can make a better world than the old people did. They were only ingenious half-humans, little better than savages, all living shut off from one another, with only clumsy words to link them. Emotions they could sometimes share, but they could not think collectively. When their conditions were primitive, they could get along all right, as the animals can. But the more complex they made their world, the less capable they were of dealing with it. They had no means of consensus. They learnt to cooperate constructively in small units, but only destructively in large units. And I'm like, yeah, okay, fair enough. Like,
is it, yeah, it's tricky because it's, yeah, you're like, well, she's got our number.
Yeah.
You know, like that seems like a fair enough summation of the human condition. So, you know, radical empath telepathy Amiga point humans probably are superior, you know?
But there is a question of what happens to the people who don't have this ability in their society.
Yeah, that you do wonder if, I don't know, that our characters have kind of escaped agrarian medieval-style eugenicists for enlightened collectivist eugenicists, basically. And I think that slight sinister undertone is meant to be present.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's very unanswered. Like, sort of, the end of the book is them arriving and it's shiny and beautiful and like David had dreamed of when he was a child. He'd sort of had this vision of it. And there's they have technology that they could only dream of, or not.
Including to kill people very quickly with sticky webs.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. They can do that. She's like, it's merciful, really. And she, and she kills, like, I don't know, 200 people. So yeah, and there is, I think, a question about what exactly does she want Petra for? You know, like, is it just, I mean, I think it's definitely, she has a lot of interest in having Petra's ability. But does she have something specific in mind? Like, because she says, you know, you'll learn how to use it better, but...
Is she like one of the child weapons in Akira? You know, like, 10 years' time, she looks really old and ancient and wrinkled up and is used to... Yeah.
Like, yeah, they're going to put her in an Ava. Anime corner on our podcast. We don't know.
There we go. But if there is anyone out there who wants to make an anime sequel to The Chrysalids, then go ahead.
It'd be good. I think it's got the makings of a good anime.
Is there a film adaptation of it? Because obviously, with Midwich Cuckoos, there's the Children of the Damned and such.
I don't think there is, you know. I think there was a radio series, a BBC radio one, and there was maybe a TV thing, but I don't think there's been a film.
Hmm. Maybe you could do one here in Suffolk.
Get Robert from the local shop. Surely that's more Midwich Cuckoos territory.
Maybe. I just wanted to get Robert from the local shop in to be like a preacher man. That'd be
Do you want to do textures of the week? Is it that time?
Oh gosh, it probably is, isn't it? I haven't got any objects to. Let's see what's in the shelf. There's nothing. I'll just hit objects. Texture of the week. I haven't broken anything.
Yeah, that was a strip back apocalyptic.
It's a minimalist percussive one.
So they don't have instruments anymore since the tribulation.
No.
They just bang things together.
It's good, we're fleshing out the world here. Do I have one? Vaguely, I mean, this isn't a particularly exciting texture, but the protagonist's back after he's been beaten and whipped by his father really struck with me, partly because it segues very quickly from before he's about to be beaten to suddenly after he's been beaten. And so we only know about what's happened basically through the description of his back and that, you know, he's crying and such. That was very vivid to me. How about you? But not especially more shapes, perhaps. I mean, I guess the thought shapes I kept sort of imagining as sort of semi-transparent, juddery, globular, translucent things, which was interesting, and obviously it was fun imagining various transmogrified creatures with long arms and legs and snouts and such.
I mean, both of mine are Badlands related.
Okay.
So the first one is from the Zealand woman who's describing, because they fly over to Labrador. This is a dreadful country indeed. We have seen Badlands before, but none of us have even imagined anything quite so terrible as this. There are stretches of miles across where it looks as if all the ground has been fused into black glass. There's nothing else, nothing but the glass like a frozen ocean of ink, then belts of Badlands, then another wilderness of black glass. Sorry, didn't attempt a New Zealand accent, because that would have been bad.
No, don't.
Yeah. but that's, I was in Oregon a fair few years back. I went to visit something called the Big Obsidian Flow, which is the remnant of volcanic eruptions, where the magma has turned to obsidian, which is this black glass, and it's very cool. So I imagine that this is suggesting volcanic eruptions and then all of that cooling into obsidian for miles. And the other one is Uncle Axel's description of the Badlands from when he was a sailor. You can see giant distorted heads of corn growing higher than small trees, big saprophytes growing on rocks with their roots trailing out in the wind like bunches of hair fathoms long. In some places, there are fungus colonies that you take at first sight for big white boulders. You can see succulents like barrels, but as big as small houses, and with spines 10 feet long. There are plants which grow on the cliff tops and send thick green cables down 100 feet and more into the sea, and you wonder whether it's a land plant that's got into the salt water, or a sea plant that's somehow climbed ashore. Like a triffid. One might.
Oh no, terrifying conjecture. Crossover special.
yeah, I enjoyed that.
Right, I know you said that I didn't have to do sign offs anymore.
Yeah.
So I thought this week's sign off, I just broadcast as a thought shape to those other sticky out belly button mutants who can understand them.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So, if you just give me a second. Okay, anyone who can receive them should have done.
Brilliant. Alright, our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, outro music's by Jay Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. See you next time, spooky kids.
Bye.
Bye.